seated. Court is ready to hear argument in 050538 in the estate of Marvin Nash.
May it please the court, Mr. McConnell, there's an argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for a vote.
May it please the court. This case gives the court an opportunity to interpret the meaning of Section 69 of the Texas Probate Code in light of the particular facts and the circumstances in this case in controversy. The facts themselves are very straightforward and can be simply stated. Mr. Marvin Nash executed a will on January 14th of 1994. In that will, he left his estate to his wife, Vicki Nash. He also named a contingent beneficiary, Shelley Tedder. Ms. Tedder was to receive upon a number of contingencies, one such contingency being, in the event my wife should predecease me. On July 8, 2002, Mr. and Mrs. Nash were divorced. They were never to remarry. Mr. Nash died on April 29, 2004. At the time of his death, Vicki Nash, his former spouse, was still alive. Those are the facts and circumstances of this case. The Texas legislature, in enacting Section 69 of the Probate Code, has provided the relevant part that if after making the will, the testator is divorced, then all provisions in the will in favor of the testator's former spouse must be read as if the former spouse failed to survive the testator.
Why do you think they added that language? What did that add to the null and void? Should we equate that with null and void, or must it mean something different because it was added?
It must mean something different, and that is one of the reasons we feel that our interpretation of the law is more correct. It means that the will, all provisions of the will, must be interpreted as if the wife had predeceased the testator, or his former spouse.
But it just doesn't say that. It says all provisions in favor of the testator's former spouse.
Well, it has provided, since it was originally enacted in 1955, the law provided that in this situation, divorce and death, the provisions favoring the former spouse were null and void. The must-be-read language, if it is limited to those provisions favoring the former spouse, then it means essentially nothing, and the legislature has essentially done a meaningless act in amending the statute in 1997. Because if the provisions favoring the former spouse are null and void, it does not matter whether it is interpreted as if she had predeceased her husband or not. Because null and void is null and void. The former spouse is not going to get the estate or serve as executor. The way it would have meaning, and
the legislature sometimes says things twice, like null and void, for instance. Why would it do violence to this, say, well, it just, and we really mean it, as to provisions in favor of the testator's spouse?
Well, null and void are pretty unambiguous. Those terms were put in the original statute. Null and void shall be of no effect. That was in 1955. And the courts had no problem. I mean, the decisions, and there aren't that many decisions on this section, but there's been no controversy that in that situation, the former spouse does not receive anything of the estate and cannot serve as an executor. That was pretty clear. There was no controversy about that. So there would have been no point in saying twice that which everyone in every court understood in the first instance, and which was by its own terms rather clear. It seems to me that the construction that the legislature must have intended something by this language means that they intended that the provisions favoring the spouse of the wife must be read, that is to say, they must be construed or interpreted as if the former spouse failed to survive the testator. And that would have meaning towards the rest of the will, including those contingent beneficiaries, such as we have in this case. Now, the Beaumont Court of Appeals and the respondents have taken a different point of view, which is that these are words of limitation, the words of limitation being all provisions in the will in favor of the testator's former spouse, that only those provisions are to be interpreted in that manner.
And I take it you don't argue that the conditional bequest is one of those provisions?
No, it is not. Okay? But what I believe the legislature has done here, it's done two things. First of all, it's provide a rule of construction. It says these provisions must be read as if. That's the rule of construction. And rather than being language of limitation, the language all provisions in the will in favor of the testator's former spouse, what that does is it identifies those portions of the will which are to be the subject of this interpretation. And if you read it in that language, the plain language of the statute could be interpreted, and I think reasonably should be interpreted to mean that those provisions are to receive that interpretation. Having interpreted that provision in that particular manner, then that naturally would affect other provisions of the will. And as I stated earlier, I really believe that is the only way that this must be read language can be given any significance or whatever, and otherwise would simply be a useless act by the legislature, which is not something this court should presume in interpreting the will of the legislature.
And you'd agree that your position is inconsistent with the Uniform Probate Code?
As it exists now.
As it exists now.
That's right. It is inconsistent with the Uniform Probate Code. But the legislature,
I was going to ask you, is there any indication that the legislature intended to depart from the Uniform Probate Court's approach?
I think when you look at the judicial landscape that existed at the time the 1997 amendment was away, there were two different camps, so to speak, from the intermediate appellate courts. Now, keep in mind, the must-be-read language at that point did not exist. It was just null and void. And the question came up, in circumstances such as we have here, well, what does that mean as far as the rest of the will, and particularly as far as contingent beneficiaries? And there were decisions, particularly the Houston and the Eastland Court of Appeals came up with their decision, which was the literal survival of a spouse precludes anyone from receiving under the estate. The Tyler Court of Appeals in Callaway versus State of Gassner, they came up with a different interpretation. They said, look, in this situation, you should look as if we should treat it as if the former spouse had predeceased the husband, therefore satisfying the contingent beneficiary who is received in that event. And at that time, this must-be-read language did not yet exist. They did this for a number of reasons, including the presumption against intestacy, because after all, we have a situation where the person named in the will, the wife, is not going to receive the estate. The only other person named is the contingent beneficiary closest to the intent of the testator. That was essentially the reasoning of the Tyler Court of Appeals in Callaway. So you have these two different camps. And Callaway also followed because at that time the Uniform Probate Code reached that result. It's since been changed. At that time, the legislature was faced with these two different camps from judicial opinions from the intermediate appellate courts. And it appears to me that the argument must be made that in enacting this must-be-read language, what the legislature did was select and essentially codify the result that was made in Callaway, because the language it essentially does the same thing. Callaway says, in this situation, read it as if the former spouse had failed to survive. The legislature says, must be read as if the former spouse failed to survive the testator. So it certainly appears, looking at the judicial history, that the legislature made a choice and decided to go with this line of cases rather than the ones that had preceded it.
Are you aware of anything in the legislative history to support that?
I have read the legislative history as far as it's been done on this case, and as is sometimes the case, I found it not very helpful. It basically restated what the language of the statute says, and I would submit to the court really that the legislative history probably does not say anything more than one could gather from reading Section 69 as it formally exists, unfortunately, but that is sometimes the case. Of course, there is talk and discussion of concern that, well, what we're doing here is rewriting the will, which is something that we ought not to do. That is the main argument which is made by the respondent. I think it's important to recognize that what the legislature has done has been changing the literal language of the will. And the approach that should be followed is that the will should read into it the statute as the time it exists. In doing that, under this case, if we were to follow the literal wording of the will, then the estate would not pass to my client, and it would not pass to the respondent's clients. It would pass to Vicki Nash, who's still alive. The literal wording of the will is not an option in this case or in any similarly situated case. In that sort of situation, the intent has been changed essentially by the legislature, with the testator is presumed to have known. So then the question becomes, you know, what are we going to do which best effectuates the intent of the testator at that time? And in doing so, Section 69 provides the judgment which has been made by the legislature as to how this ought to be treated. And they have basically given us the same thing that Callaway gave us in the Tyler Court of Appeals many years ago. And that is that we are to treat the situation as if the former spouse had predeceased. In that sort of situation, it would satisfy the contingent beneficiary. So it is not a question of whether we are to rewrite the will. It is a question of, are we going to give effect to the intent of the legislature? And also, I would say this. There has been this judicial division which had existed before this statute was amended, which I alluded to earlier. And it seems to me that the issue now is not whether McFarland versus McFarland was the best reasoned decision or whether Callaway versus Gassner is the best reasoned decision, but rather it is, having examined those decisions and having made their choice, what was the intent of the legislature? And the only way the legislature's language can be given meaning and effect is to follow the interpretation which the petitioner has advanced in this case.
If the must-be-read phrase were not in the statute, you agree that respondents should prevail?
I would probably, in that instance, still argue, I would, as counsel, argue that Callaway was the better reasoned decision. But under this circumstance, I would say that is no law. That is no longer the question. The question now is, what did the Texas legislature mean when they added this language? Obviously, I think the addition of this language, which so closely parallels Callaway, is the controlling issue now. I will entertain any other questions of the court.
Seems there are no further questions. Thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
You.
Tunnell. And the court is now ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Deaton will present argument for the respondents.
Please support. Greetings from East Texas. It seems as though this is a Lufkin thing. I noticed the clerk of the court is from Lufkin, or his parents were. And because it is a small town, I had the privilege of knowing Marvin Nash and Judge Moore, who penned the Callaway-Gassner decision, that was also a judge in our great part of Texas. Turning first to the will, I think Judge Greenhill said it so well, and we were all raised on Judge Greenhill in law school. He said, you know, the intent of the testator should be drawn from the will, not the will from the intent of the testator. And I think that's what esteemed counsel is trying to do. The will is clear. The will, Marvin Nash and Vicki Nash divorced. Marvin Nash actually lost control of the wills. They were in Colorado. Marvin Nash came into my office to draw another will. We drew another will. He was out of town. He died while he was before he could execute it. I don't think knowing that there was another, that the wills were still in place. But the will is clear. The will has three contingencies. What he really said to his stepdaughter, who he loved, he said, if your mother survives me, then I don't want you to get anything. However, if your mother predeceases me, then I will take care of you in my will. He said that in three different ways. He said if we die in a simultaneous accident,
did he use the term mother or did he use the term wife?
I'm sorry, it was his wife at the time that the wills were executed.
Certainly a difference there, right?
Stepdaughter's mother. I'm sorry.
Certainly a difference.
Yes, sir. I agree with you. And I should have said wife, I guess. He said that in three different ways. He said if she survives me, then I want my stepdaughter to be for her to take care of her own child, I guess. But he said it in three different ways in the will. He said if she survives me, if we die in a common accident, or if she survives me for 30 days. In other words, if at any time in this situation, if she predeceased him, and I think it's very clear in the will, then Shelley Tedder was not to take under the terms and conditions of the will. So to honor Judge Greenhill, the intent's very clear in the will as to what he meant. He said what he meant, and I'm reminded of this court's decision in a recent case I just came across. That would be Enterprise Leasing versus Houston versus Berrios, and you use words such as unambiguous, clear, words that were cases that are hard cases to decide, but when the wording is clear, the decision has to be made in that regard. I think this case, the will definitely is clear and has no ambiguity.
Turning, you got any idea why the legislature added must be read to Section 69?
You know, I don't, Judge. I too have looked at the legislative intent, I looked at the Uniform Probate Code, the Model Probate Code. I've looked at all those statutes. I know how they are now, Judge McNeil. I agree with you. They're not that way. They certainly don't require that reading now. I even attached a copy of the Montana Probate Code, which I think is probably a pretty uniform model part of that. I do not know why they put that in there other than for redundancy. I'm a pilot and was a pilot for a while, and I realized I was always happy when there was a redundant system on board, and so that was that may have been the reason behind it.
So they said it three times, and they thought maybe a fourth was... would help.
I think so, Judge. But in looking at that statute, the statute itself is clear. It says that it only has application to gifts that pertain to the spouse. It does not apply to contingent beneficiaries. And of course, what I think opposing counsel would ask is that basically we throw 175 years of stare decisis from what we know in Texas to be true, that we mean what we say and say what we mean, and what this court has a reputation for doing, is that we throw it out the window. We take this this statute and basically make it mean what opposing counsel wants it to. Incidentally, Mr. Tunnell and I are good friends. We office right next to each other. And I don't think we can do that. I don't think that bears fruit for Texas, bears fruit for these situations. I do think it's clear. I want to tell you, I'm going to give you some time back. I appreciate you putting sort of closing this chapter in Marvin Nash's life, which I, as I told you, was a good friend, and some of his relatives are in the courtroom today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Deaton. May it please the court, just a few words. I suppose it could be said that Mr. Nash said what he meant what he said when he provided that upon his death he wished for his estate to pass to his wife, Vicki Nash. It contains no provision saying, except in the event
that we should get divorced or anything of that nature. And so it's not going to Vicki Nash. Why not? Because the Texas legislature has enacted Section 69 and it applied to this will. And that when you interpret the meaning of the will, the things you look at, it's not whether you know Mr. Nash or any of those circumstances. It's not whether he was had another will he was going to execute but did not. You look at the law and you look at the will. The law provides that provisions favoring Vicki Nash must be read as if she had predeceased her husband. The will says Shelley Tester is to receive the estate, Shelley Tedder is to receive the estate in the event my wife should predecease me. You apply that law, you look at the will, they match and dovetail perfectly. That is clear and unambiguous.
Is it? What do you say to Mr. Deaton's argument that the will says if my then-wife survives, if she's alive, she takes care of her daughter?
Well, the language is, in the event my wife and I die at the same time, or in the event she does not survive me by 30 days, or in the event that my wife should predecease me, then, and in either of these events, I give so forth.
Under the will, what happens in the event she is alive? That she's living. He dies and she's living. What happens?
Well, in this situation, I think you have to read provisions favoring her as if she had predeceased.
But in the will, what would the result be?
The will, under the will, it would go to Vicki Nash, his wife, mm-hmm. because it makes no provision for disqualifying her in the event of divorce. That is provided by the law. So that would be the result if you went strictly by the will.
But you had a problem, it seems to me, that what do you do, obviously, going back, when someone dies and they've been divorced, yet the will, is in this case, still has the ex-wife there. So the legislature intended, it seems to me, to fix that. But to go beyond fixing that itself would be in terms of changing the intent of the testator, don't you think?
Well, they had provided before that the wife, the divorced spouse, is not to receive the estate. That was already there. So, and that had been there since 1955 and uniformly held by the courts to be the case.
Exactly. That was to fix that problem.
But then in 1997, they had this to fix the problem that had come up through the courts of what do you do about contingent beneficiaries. And I think that was the intent. And if that is not the intent, then this language is pure and simple a redundancy. And I think it goes against the cardinal rules of construction for the last 100 years or so of this court to say that the legislature did a meaningless and fruitless thing.
But the first alternate disposition is not in favor of the former spouse.
That's correct.
And so why does Section 69 apply at all?
It should apply because those provisions that did favor the former spouse are those provisions which are subject to the rule of interpretation that the legislature has provided. And that rule of interpretation, it identifies which provisions are to be interpreted. And the interpretation is that it must be read as if the former spouse had predeceased the testator.
But it's ones that are in favor of the former spouse must be read that way.
That's correct. And must be interpreted that way is how I would.
But the first alternate is not in favor of the former spouse.
That is correct. That is correct.
And there's no question that Ms. Nash didn't die at the same time.
She did not die at the same time. She was living at the time of Mr. Nash's death.
Did survive him by 30 days.
That's correct.
And
That is correct. The historical fact is that Ms. Nash survived her husband and that none of those contingencies came forth. It is our position that the contingency for which Ms. Tedder would receive the estate is satisfied by the language of Section 69.
Conceptually, is it your view that Section 69 changes the will or fills in a missing term?
I think that you have to read both the Section 69 as if it was part of the will. I think that when you read the will, you must read those provisions which require its interpretation at the same time and as part of the will. That's my position.
Without Section 69, the result would be different, though.
Without Section 69, the result would be that Mrs. Nash would receive the estate, his former wife.
No, it would be because that request would then be null and void.
Well, I believe the question was if Section 69 did not exist, in that event, Ms. Nash would receive the estate.
Any further questions? Thank you. Mr. Tunnel, the call is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.